This is KJZZ, your news and information station in Phoenix and across Arizona. I'm Tiara Vian, and here are this week's stories you don't want to miss. It's the podcast designed to catch you up on some highlights from around the region. Thanks for listening. Here are a few of the stories for the week of November 10th, 2025. With the government shutdown ended, Governor Katie Hobbs says most Arizonans who rely on food assistance already have their benefits restored. Wayne Schutzke reports.
Over the course of the 43-day government shutdown, nearly 900,000 Arizonans who used the SNAP program faced uncertainty over how they would afford food this month.
We just went through this arduous fight over giving the most vulnerable Arizonans benefits so that they could put food on their table.
With the government reopened, Hobbs says that uncertainty is over.
I think most Arizonans have already gotten their full funding.
Hobbs says anyone who hasn't received their benefits should get them by the end of the week. The deal to end the shutdown signed by President Trump on Wednesday included full SNAP funding through September 2026. Wayne Schutzke, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
In politics news. Earlier this year, the Trump administration cut funding to AmeriCorps, a national program that helps those in need, including homebound seniors. Arizona Attorney General Chris Mays and other AGs sued and won the release of millions in federal funding. Kathy Ritchie recently met up with one AmeriCorps volunteer and her client in the West Valley and has this story.
89-year-old Bertie Madison is a petite woman with blondish white curls. She uses a walker because of her degenerative disc disease, and she's legally blind. Verdi has her shopping list out, written in cursive. She hands it to 75-year-old Karen Alexander, who's pushing an empty Walmart shopping cart.
First thing on the list is applesauce and salt.
Salt and graham crackers?
And graham crackers. And
that's a good choice.
Karen is a volunteer with Caring Circles, an AmeriCorps program that assists older homebound adults. Besides Verdi, she supports nine other seniors who need help with doctor's appointments and grocery runs. But on this day, Verdi and Karen have an extra set of hands. Arizona Attorney General Chris Mays is shopping with them.
Have you noticed the prices going up lately?
Yes, but yesterday the eggs were down a dollar something. Bought eggs.
Good. Okay.
So, the two carry on chatting about the high cost of food, with the exception of those eggs.
And I told Karen, I said, look at the date on them. Maybe they're old. Because I couldn't believe it, you know, that they were
That's
so
smart.
Cheap.
That's smart.
Bertie is on a fixed income. She lives off Social Security and her late husband's Coast Guard pension. To fill the gaps, she picks up a food box from St. Mary's Food Bank once a month. Verdi is also one of roughly 16 million Americans, 65 and older, who lives alone. She has four daughters. The closest one lives in the East Valley.
She has MS and she's blinder than me, so we can help each other.
So 2 years ago, Verdi called the Area Agency on Aging, where she was connected to Caring Circles and Karen.
Almost all of my clients are living on their own, but their family, either they don't have any family or their families live out of state. So they depend on people like me.
And hiring someone like Karen to provide non-medical support isn't cheap. The median cost of a home health aide in Arizona is $36 an hour. Verdi also wants to stay in her own home.
I don't like other people in my kitchen, so I think that it would be hard for me to live. One of my daughters asked me, Mom, if you meet somebody, would you marry again? I said, they probably couldn't live with me. I've lived alone too long.
Without a volunteer coming by to help, Verdi would likely have a tough time living alone. And she did when the Trump administration cut off funding for the AmeriCorps program. Jesse Sandoval is the AmeriCorps director for the Area Agency on Aging in Maricopa County.
I think the hardest part was calling all our clients. We had nearly 450 clients at that time.
And because it happened on a Friday afternoon, Sandoval says they were calling volunteers and clients over the weekend. Some even had appointments that Monday. Karen was with Verdi at the time.
When I told her that, you know, I wouldn't be able to help her anymore, and she kind of, first it was like, oh, wow, I'm sorry to hear that they cut the program. And then she started to panic because she's thinking, oh, well, how am I going to get to the grocery store? How am I going to get my medication?
Verdi calls Karen a godsend.
I've told her that. I said, I don't know what I would do without you. You better not go away again, because she went away once.
And when that happened, Verdi called Arizona's two senators and the White House. She doesn't know if President Trump got her message, but she did vote for him, which she reminded the staffer who took her call.
I told him about this program, how it means so much to me because that I'm legally blind and I, you know, it's like I'm just totally lost without some help.
About a half hour later, Mae says goodbye to Jesse, Karen, and Bertie. Back inside the car, she settles in for the drive back to her office.
Wow, that was really cool to be able to see exactly what the AmeriCorps program is all about. I've never done that before, and just really striking when Bertie said that she voted for Donald Trump, but and also called the White House to complain that they were canceling the program. Was like, well, good for her, first of all. Good for her.
It's unclear how many volunteers nationwide support older adults, but a 2021 report by the Administration for Community Living found that in fiscal year 2019, the economic value of volunteers like Karen was equal to approximately $1.7 billion, a figure that's likely higher today. Kathy Ritchie, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
And this is the Stories You Don't Want to Miss podcast. Thanks for listening. KJZZ's team of dedicated journalists bring you accurate and unbiased reporting. This commitment to thorough local journalism is what sets KJZZ apart, but the reality is quality reporting costs a lot of money. Your financial contribution helps fill the gap in funding. Please begin a monthly sustaining donation today at kjzz.org, and thank you. In business news, we hear a lot about how artificial intelligence will change our future. It's expected to transform fields like healthcare, education, data analysis, and transportation. And in many ways, it already has. Phil Latzman recently visited with some Arizona small business owners to hear how they're implementing AI into their operations.
Hundreds of small business owners and entrepreneurs gathered in Scottsdale last month to talk strategy at the Grow 2025 conference, presented by the public company Thrive, which specializes in helping the little guy.
We're a software business. We work with small businesses and help them get found, you know, by customers, help them convert that interest into a sale, and then help them nurture those customers so they come back in the future.
That's Joe Walsh, who is CEO of Texas-based Thrive. Lately, he says the AI landscape has been shifting quickly as humans, especially young people, have become more comfortable with it. He believes it could be a game changer for his clients.
And, you know, when you have a new paradigm show up, whatever it is, it sort of breaks down some of the incumbent advantages and opens the playing field for you to go again. You know, like there's an all-new way to play. You know, when the internet showed up, that happened. You know, when the advent of mobile, that happened. That's happening now with AI.
How it's happening depends on the business, of course.
AI, I think, for us is limited right now.
Jennifer George is the owner of Northern Arizona Roof Services in Flagstaff.
We use drones. There's also programs like Eagle View or Gaff Measure that uses satellite to measure the roofs and then report to us square footages and that information. So it is already being used in the industry.
She says they also use it for appointments and other automated reminders and will soon need it for just about everything. Angela O'Keer is in a similar business. She's the product manager for the Phoenix-based ChimSpect, which specializes in chimney inspection software.
I use AI every single day to organize my business and to get better at what I do.
It's a virtual right hand for her.
You know, all of us, it's really easy to say, help me edit this email. That's just like the very basic level of what it can do. How can you analyze my website? What do I need to change? How am I matching up with my competitors? What can I do to improve? Asking it how I can improve. I mean, it's just amazing.
From roofs and chimneys to video production.
So AI is impacting us in a variety of different ways, but it's not replacing us.
Patrick Noon is VP of Marketing at Scottsdale-based Multimedia Communications.
We're using it mostly on like technology and editing and the cameras, so our processes are getting faster and becoming more affordable.
But he says they aren't replacing humans in his business and hopefully never will.
I'm concerned about that, obviously. I think there's a lot of AI out there that can pseudo-human people, right? I don't think it's going to be a full replacement. There is still the one-to-one. There still is the relationship part of it, and that's where we really focus.
Meanwhile, could you soon be visiting your AI dentist?
It's changing every day, but right now we're mainly using it for appointments, for reminders, for basically advertising and marketing, but it's coming.
Dr. Cameron Ruentin has been practicing dentistry for more than 30 years in the Valley.
What about working on your teeth? I mean, is that going to happen?
I hope not, but, you know, it will get close, I bet.
And who better than a fortune teller to ask about the future of artificial intelligence?
I use AI to take the information that I get from the spirits or guides, whatever you want to call that, and turn it into like emails and blog posts and that kind of thing. So I use it to help save time.
Yes, Bob Stahl is a professional psychic, and he predicts...
Clearly, it's going to have a bigger role in our life and in our economy and all of those places. I feel like there does need to be some sense of control on it, but I feel like there's so much more positive things about it because it has helped my business tremendously.
And while some fear AI could possibly end the world, Thrive's Joe Walsh believes the benefits will outweigh the negatives.
I think the net positive is enormous, and there are obviously every good thing comes with a couple of bad things. So, you know, there will be ways that we'll have to guard against it and protect it, and people will find some diabolical things that they'll do with it. But I think that there's a huge net positive.
In Scottsdale, where AI hasn't replaced me yet, Phil Latzman, KJZZ News.
In Fronteras News, residents in Hermosillo are demanding answers and accountability after an explosion in the state capital's busy city center killed at least 24 people. From the Fronteras desk in Hermosillo, Nina Kravinsky reports.
At a march in Hermosillo in the days after the November 1st blast, shock had turned to anger and calls for justice. Six children under 10 years old were killed in this month's explosion at a Waldo's discount store. State investigators say the explosion seems to be linked to a transformer located inside the building. They say most of the people killed died from inhaling toxic gas. The store where the explosion and fire took place had been operating since 2021 without state safety protocols in place, authorities said after the blast. Now, the state prosecutor's office is investigating whether or not the event was caused by wrongdoing on the part of the store owners or public officials. We want an impartial and objective investigation, says Patty Duarte, a march leader and longtime activist. Her three-year-old son was killed in a 2009 daycare fire in Hermosillo that killed 49 children. The November 1st fire has a lot of similarities to what happened in 2009, Duarte says. In the 16 years after that fire, several public officials have avoided serving time or had their sentences drastically reduced, despite being accused or found guilty of negligence. In a message to Sonorans on social media, Governor Alfonso Durazo acknowledged the 2009 tragedy and the resulting lack of trust in public officials when he announced the head of the state Civil Protection Service would be removed for the duration of the investigation into the Waldo's fire.
Esa sombra aún pesa sobre nuestra memoria colectiva.
That shadow weighs on our collective memory, says Durazo. The city of Hermosillo also removed the leader of its civil protection service. Both said they did so in an effort to ensure an impartial investigation. One of the owners of the daycare that burned in 2009 was recently sent back to Mexico from Arizona and is now detained in Hermosillo. She's been wanted in Mexico for years for crimes related to that fire. In the wake of the Waldo's fire, Durazo says there will be no impunity.
Con plena responsabilidad.
I will take the necessary decisions to make sure there's a before and after in this story, said Durazo. He says experts from two national-level universities and a national group of risk management professionals will carry out assessments in addition to the state prosecutor's investigation. But outside the state government offices, protesters cast doubt on whether that investigation would lead to justice after what they see as a lack of accountability for the public officials who allowed the daycare to operate, despite major safety issues with the building. Protesters like Duarte called for a structural change from state, city, and federal leaders to prevent disasters like the Waldo's fire in the first place. Not enough has changed since the 2009 fire, Duarte says. How many more will die? Waldo's has said on social media that it will continue providing funds to families of victims for medical costs and funeral expenses, and that it's working with local authorities in their investigation. 68 locations of the store closed in the state of Sonora after the fire. Mexican President Claudia Sheinbaum called for a deep investigation.
Y entonces de ahí pues hay que deslindar responsabilidades.
From there, it's necessary to assign responsibility, Sheinbaum said. Rosalinda Rios Trasviña's 25-year-old daughter was killed in the fire. Her daughter, who worked as a cashier at Waldo's, and her boyfriend were planning to buy a house soon and start a life together. Rios Trasvina says if there isn't accountability and change, there will be more disasters like this. I'm demanding justice so that doesn't happen, so that other mothers don't have to feel the pain that I feel. Nina Kravinsky, KJZZ News, Hermosillo.
And this is the Stories You Don't Want to Miss podcast. In Tribal Natural Resources, supported in part by a grant from the Katina Foundation. The Colorado River has long been considered a lifeline for the Southwest. Gabriel Piacerazio reports one Arizona tribe is acknowledging the waterway as having the same rights and legal protections as tribal members.
The Colorado River Indian Tribes, or CRIT, would not say whether it was unanimous, but the nine council members still voted to recognize personhood for the namesake river under tribal law. It comes at a pivotal time when sustained drought threatens this natural resource CRIT considers a living entity, running parallel to the tribe's nearly 300,000-acre reservation along the California border. This measure also tasked tribal councils to take the Colorado River's needs under consideration amid an uncertain future on two fronts, climate change and ongoing water negotiations. Gabriel Piacerazio, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
In education news, the Phoenix Union High School District will cut $20 million from its budget next school year. From the Education Desk, Bridget Dowd reports.
The district says the reduction is necessary as it continues to see declines in enrollment. Just this year, Phoenix Union has lost about 1,800 students. That's in addition to a 1,200-student decline last year. In a video message to the community, Superintendent Thea Andrade said reasons for the decline are complex.
Arizona is consistently ranked at the bottom, as you know, nationally, in per-pupil funding. We've also seen a continued expansion of Empowerment Scholarship Accounts, or ESAs. In addition, more families may be choosing charter schools.
Andrade says that, compounded with soaring home prices and lower birth rates, means that fewer families are staying in the area. District officials say they'll release a list of staff positions that they plan to eliminate in December. Bridget Dowd, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
And finally, from KJZZ's The Show. One of the places in the U.S. you can contract Valley fever is now facing vaccine backlash. Here's co-host Mark Brody.
The State Department of Health Services reports more than 10,000 reported cases of Valley fever so far this year. There were nearly 11,000 cases in 2023, the last year for which data are available. But research into treatment for the fungal disease continues, as does work on a vaccine to prevent it. Dr. John Galgiani is director of the Valley Fever Center for Excellence at the University of Arizona College of Medicine in Tucson. He joins me to talk about that research, as well as its future, with federal research dollars more uncertain now. And John, where are we right now in learning about this ailment and maybe how to prevent and treat it?
Well, the vaccine is probably the most exciting. We do many things, as you said. The vaccine is well along in its development towards a veterinary vaccine. We're working with Anavive Life Sciences, which is the company that licensed the discovery we made maybe 12 or 13 years ago. And they are a veterinary product company, and they have been working with us to take this discovery through what's called the Valley of Death, the really difficult part of taking something that might be good into something that is really useful. And they're on their way to probably have a vaccine approved by the USDA for dogs in veterinary clinics for use within a year.
Hmm. And at what point then, like how much clinical research and trials do you have to go through before you get the kind of data you need to get to see if this is going to be effective in humans?
Yes. Yeah, so the vaccine for humans is approved through the FDA. Whereas the veterinary vaccine goes through USDA, and all of the information in the USDA file becomes available to FDA. But frankly, it is primarily preclinical data. It becomes efficacy in a different species. But really, other than that, you pretty much start over. You need a new manufacturing process, and then you have to do additional safety tests, and then you start doing clinical trials.
Well, so when you talk about vaccines and needing to go through the FDA, I mean, I kind of feel compelled to ask about the current situation we're in terms of some changes with vaccines, not for Valley Fever, but for other vaccines. Does it make you nervous maybe that the current environment, the current administration might be less receptive, for example, to a Valley Fever vaccine than others?
I think it's very much worthwhile reading the newspapers about what's going on around the country. But that said, this disease, Valley Fever, is considered an equal opportunity disease. It's been supported by Republicans. It's been supported by Democrats. And no, it doesn't really, and I think people are interested in it, regardless of the overall thought about vaccines. And this vaccine is sort of interesting in that it's not for a contagious disease. So in fact, there's no compelling reason to get the vaccine other than if you think you want to be protected.
And probably if you live in a place where you might be more susceptible to getting Valley Fever, right?
That's right. Absolutely. It's of no value if you live in Alaska, where right. In fact, turns out there are no Valley Fever cases, at least endemically. But if you live here, where two-thirds of all U.S. infections come from Arizona, then the risk is about 4% per year of getting infected. And if you're of a mind that a vaccine makes sense, then it'd be wonderful to have the vaccine. If you don't have the vaccine, you don't have that option. Whereas people who really don't want to take the vaccine, there's no compelling public health reason for you to do it other than for your own personal health.
Is your research or the research of some of the folks with whom you work affected at all by reduced grant funding from the federal government, from the NIH?
So the original work we did was on a grant several years ago, which is where we showed that the vaccine was very effective in preventing Valley Fever in dogs. And since then, last year, the company I mentioned, Anavive, got a contract from NIAID, from NIH, to take the vaccine from where we are now into the first human trial. And so far, that contract has been going through. We've been continuing to work under that.
Are you concerned that that contract might be canceled at some point?
Well, I'm concerned that that would be a problem. It did. But at the moment, it hasn't been. And we think there's really no reason it should be. And I think there's support for the work to be done.
I'm curious about just sort of the general work that the center is able to do. It sounds as like maybe some of the support, some of the infrastructure might also have been affected or might be affected by some of the changes coming from D.C.
Well, that's a complicated question. The infrastructure at the University of Arizona is whatever. And I actually have very little to know about that.
Sure.
But our offices are open and we continue to do our work. The work that is being done on the contract is not, at least we are subcontractors on that contract to Anavive, but at this point it has not really been affected. And I've gotten, you know, support. In fact, the center itself has been primarily supported on philanthropic support. And then the other thing that we are really interested in doing is not so much bench research, which we do quite a bit of, but also to get people aware of this disease. And I've this year actually completely came to the obvious conclusion, after I realized that it was pretty obvious, that awareness is where it all starts. If you don't know about a problem, you're not going to worry about it. And it turns out with Valley Fever, if you know about Valley Fever before you get sick, and this is Arizona Department of Health Services data, you're going to get a diagnosis sooner than if you don't know about Valley Fever, because people ask, don't you think you should test me? And it turns out that's a very important question, because many physicians don't remember to test for Valley Fever even when they should. And so we're really working on that. And then if you don't get the diagnosis and you're sick with Valley Fever, you're being treated for all sorts of things you don't have, none of which helps you. And so once you get a diagnosis, then you get precise care for the diagnosis you have. And the final thing is, once you know there's a problem here, you start asking, wait a minute, why are the diagnostics so slow to get results back? And it turns out it would be really nice if we had a point-of-care test. And these drugs don't cure this disease. They help, mm-hmm. but they don't cure it. So why don't we have a cure for this disease yet? And I heard about a vaccine that was invented at the U of A. We really should promote. So, I mean, awareness leads not only to better health for the individual, But I think it also leads to the basis for doing support for a disease that's very important to the state's economy, not just public health. But managing this problem is really, really important.
Well, it sounds like what you're saying is awareness is important both for patients and healthcare providers, but also for policymakers so that they continue to support the kind of research that leads to better outcomes.
I think that's absolutely right. And not only policymakers, but I think there are constituent stakeholders. I think professional sports, for example, real estate, if you want to attract new industry to the state, I think you need to manage this problem. And there was a magazine report in Money, Inc. in February 2024, where they talked about if you're thinking about relocating to Arizona, there are a few things you should know about just before you make that decision. 9 things they went through.
Hmm.
Number one problem that they identified was valley fever.
Really?
Now, I think that's misguided. I don't think the more you know about valley fever, the less anxiety-producing it is. But it is a management issue. And I think not only for managing the message, but also actually doing the best we can. And if you have a managing program, it's better than pretending it doesn't exist.
All right. That is Dr. John Galgiani, director of the Valley Fever Center for Excellence at the University of Arizona College of Medicine. John, good to see you again. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
And this has been the Stories You Don't Want to Miss podcast, made possible in part by Helios Education Foundation and Alliance Bank, the Vitalist Health Foundation, the Intel Corporation and Beach Fleischman, the Arizona Community Foundation, and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Thank you for listening and for your generous support. I'm Tiara Vian. This is KJZZ. Listen more, learn more online and on the KJZZ mobile app.